So, Shinjin Mei, session 9. We continue. We were finishing up this paragraph. So I'm going to go to the beginning of it, and then we will work with the last line. Fixation of thought is unnatural, yet laziness of mind is undesirable. Not wanting to wear down the spirit, why do you hold dear or alienate? Also, another translation, making distinctions. Why do you hold dear or alienate? And this is from the commentary. Living in a mode that makes distinctions and separations between this and that according to one's own preferences, the average person sees the pursuit of food, sex, sleep, wealth, objects, or fame as benefits that will make life worthwhile and fulfilling. Little does the average person realize the annoyance and weariness that comes from headlong pursuit of these presumed rewards, or even the ultimate pointlessness of these pursuits. We all have the arrogance that we are smart enough to escape the negative results of these pursuits, and that we can do what other people are not able to do. In other words, as he says, have our cake and eat it too. The experience of each person in each generation has been that real life just doesn't work that way. Equanimity is not to be found in these pursuits, in the world of internal chatter, in judgments, in discriminations, in wanting things to be this way and not that way. So, being arrogant. Let's take a few minutes and examine our arrogance. Because we all are that. To different, varying degrees, there is that arrogance in us. I think often not so, we may not see it as clearly, but it is in the background. And there is this self-centeredness of, I know that I'll be able, I think I will be able to do what other people are not able to or have not been able to do because I am different. I'm different. So, yeah, how do we feel about that? There's somebody on Zoom waiting. Can you allow them in? No, it's okay. They got it. They got it. No, they don't. Thank you. Okay, great. So, living in a mode that makes distinctions, separations with this and that according to one's preferences. So the average person, right, all of us have this, right? See, pursuit of food, sex, sleep, wealth, objects, or fame as benefits that will make life worthwhile and fulfilling. Does it work? So what about that? What about this in relation to equanimity, as he says? Anyone? Yeah.
I mean, personally reading it, I got especially tripped up on the part, this is not wanting to wear down the spirit. And maybe that could just be a translation quirk, but what I hear from that is often the things we do, whether it's holding closer or creating distance, is in an effort to protect something.
Mm-hmm.
Of I'm trying to preserve my energy. You know, we talk about it with the precepts of stinginess,
mm-hmm.
of you know, trying to hold back something or create a distance. I don't want you're threatening to me, or undesirable. You know, certain types of people, homeless people, suffering, just plain, we want a distance from it. I think there's a lot of stuff to get through the day that we kind of have to pretend are true sometimes, or we're convinced that that's the way to do it. When you bring up arrogance, or why am I, I'm different, I can do this. So, like, maybe sometimes you might rely on that to hype yourself up with, like, I can do this, other people have tried, but I think I could do it. I could pull this off. I think what happens is where you stray is when you start to drink your own Kool-Aid a little bit too much and mistake what you're saying as reality. But I don't know.
Right. So yeah, and it arises from the notion of separation, right? Notion of self and other are two, right? That I'm here and you're there, mm-hmm. and that's fixed, right? The notion of me versus everything else, right? Mm-hmm. So it arises out of that. It also strengthens that, as we're saying. Yeah. So you're saying there is that identification as it arises. Right, it arises and then we become identified with it, mm-hmm. which means we just keep going in that direction, right? And what he's saying here is that point, the ultimate pointlessness of these pursuits, right? So, and the awareness that comes from headlong pursuit, mm-hmm. of the presumed rewards.
I think,
the presumed rewards, right?
I think the arrogance has, takes many forms. At least I have many of them. And they're all kind of arrogance in many ways, but the one that I think they're referring this in this text is more the arrogance that we can reach happiness or that is the reward they're talking about. It's like a fulfillment of your life as a happiness, like what we define, we say, oh yeah, I will get to that no restlessness kind of situation, mm-hmm. if I can get more things or mm-hmm. if I can get more whatever. And that is what we think, that's the arrogance he's talking, it's a very specific one, mm-hmm. I think. It's not like the arrogance that, I can be a better doctor than that other person, which is also an arrogance, but it's like a more, it's not what this is talking about. This is talking about the kind of the lifelong arrogance that we can actually do what nobody else could do, which is just derive happiness from the pursuit of things.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I do believe that we all have, to a certain degree, even though it's an interesting point, and that we all share that. We all believe that. Yeah. I mean, that person may not be happy with this, but I can be. Because I know that I will be when I get to that. And having them pass some of those accumulations, it's certainly you don't get anything from it. They're cool every now and then, but they're not really getting you to the no restlessness kind of situation that we all seek. So how do we drop that arrogance is like an interesting question, because it's so embedded into what we do as a society and as many other things that we need to get. We confuse the pursuit of food with the pursuit of everything else. And food we need, we can say, okay, we need certain things. Yes, we do. But we confuse that and we create that for that, we need all this. Because if you don't have a degree, you are not gonna eat. If you don't and it's like that is the confusion that we actually start kind of generating, I think.
Right, and we put that kind of pressure on our kids too, right?
Totally.
And then, so we train them to fit that. We train them to function in that realm with the same rules, right? Until you have achieved this, this, and that, your worthiness is questionable. Your worthiness will be something when all those things are reached, right? But the last line is the experience of each person in each generation has been that real life doesn't work this way. Just doesn't work this way, right? So arriving at that, and the experience, the fact that other people arrived at that conclusion doesn't mean that we're gonna ride their conclusion. We have to arrive at the same conclusion through our own trying again and again, realizing it doesn't work. Everybody has to do the same, right? Fall down, realize it's not going to deliver. Then we turn somewhere else, or then we turn inwardly. And then real work begins. But we have to abandon, this way of being for any other real pursuit to start to manifest. Right? And the other thing is, you talk about food. Yeah, there are basic needs. The question is, how do we do it, right? Do we do it because it's a basic need of the body, or do we do it to look for something? Are we seeking or are we expressing? That's the difference. Expressing is one thing. Seeking is another. Then you try, and this food, that restaurant, this recipe. It's never going to work. So, yeah, you want to say something? Okay, we'll continue, and if it comes to you, we'll go back to that. Anyone else? Okay, so how do we get out of it, right? So to enter the one vehicle, this is the next paragraph, to enter the one vehicle, be not prejudiced against the six dusts. To have no prejudice toward the six dusts, the senses, is to come into true enlightenment, to have no rejection towards, right? And the senses, right? So we think, well, the problem is with the senses. So if I shut down those senses, I will be able to arrive somewhere, right? But then I'm rejecting something. I'm rejecting a natural expression or aspect of my being, right? So is the problem with the senses, or is the problem with the way we use the senses? Another translation, true reality is hidden by the practice of thought, but also in the denial. Accept the reality of not naming things and rest in the silence of being. So that's this line, great advice for Zazen in general, right? Accept the reality of not naming things and rest in the silence of being. Which is a job description for Zazen, right? Use your senses to experience reality, for they are part of your empty mind. Not just part of your mind, part of your empty mind. Empty in sense of not fixed. This empty mind takes note of all it perceives, and it is guided by its sensing needs. So it is guided by its sensing needs. So those senses are necessary for us to function. They guide us. So that's not a problem. The problem is, are we trying to do something with it that is not designed to do? Right? It's not designed to give us definition, for example, right? Or a sense of self-worth. And Linji also said, the six rays never cease to emit the great light. So the six rays, the six senses, including thinking mind, always emit the great light. This is how it is expressing itself. It is expressing itself rather than me expressing myself. In the commentary, it says, equanimity is not a rejection of anything. It is knowing that putting your hand in the fire is not a profitable enterprise. This is an interesting way of saying that, right? Putting your hand in the fire is not a profitable enterprise. The question is, how long does it take us to realize that it's not profitable, that it doesn't work? Not only doesn't work, it actually leads to further suffering, which is why hand in the fire is a good way of describing it. Knowing that the headlong pursuit of food, sex, sleep, fame, and fortune will only result in dismay and weariness. Equanimity allies itself with a quality of restraint in one's life that is not based on dislike or rejection of anything, but is grounded rather in the wisdom experience of self-knowing and a knowing of the world. So restraint, right? And this is something that the Buddha spoke about. We speak about it often, right? A discipline or disciplined practice. And the other side of that is that notion that if I do whatever I want, whenever I want, I will be happy, or I am happy and free by doing whatever I want, whenever I want. And we tried, right? We all tried, and we all realized at some point it doesn't work. It doesn't deliver that, right? And that's what we have to go through to realize and then turn towards spiritual practice to discover different kind of power, innate power, right? So Jodeki versus Tadeki, right? Jodeki, spiritual power, is not dependent on anything, and Tadeki is worldly power that's dependent on other people giving you enough thumbs up, and then other people saying, yeah, you are worthy because you are great, because you have this amount of knowledge, this amount of money, this many assets. Now, we all agree that you are worthy, and we do it. We do it. I think a great example was a couple of weeks ago with submarine, right, that was lost and unfortunately imploded. The amount of attention that they got versus a week before, right, the refugees lost in the Mediterranean, right? That's how we are. I think this is actually very indicative of the way we are, of what we crown and what we ignore. So it's actually a good teaching. When you look at the reaction, go back, read about it. You look at the reaction of the world to those two incidents, which were a week apart. It's a good indication of our state of being, or what we perceive as important and then less important. Rich people, somehow we think, are more wealthy because they are, by numbers, more wealthy. Right? So we quantify, because we quantify, as long as we quantify, numbers matter. And it is a game of numbers. So what he's saying, equanimity allies itself with a quality of restraint in one's life that is not based on dislike or rejection of anything, but is grounded rather in the wisdom experience of self-knowing and a knowing of the world. What's that? What is knowing of the world? What does it mean to know the world? There's no failing or passing. Say whatever you want. It's all good. Is that what you're waiting for? Okay. Okay, Kojin, shoot. You're a numbers guy, right?
The world is to know how things naturally function. It's the natural state of things, not the overlay that we put on things, which is where we get trapped. So, you know, I was thinking about fame and sex and money and all those things. You know, they're all byproducts, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're all derivative things. They're not so. When you focus headlong on a derivative outcome or a derivative result, you're missing the true path of what it takes to get there, right? Like if you run headlong into the world to make money, then money becomes your master, and then you're not free,
mm-hmm.
right? But if you see money as a derivative outcome of something else that you're doing, then you're free to do anything, and money is byproduct of that. So we get so hung up on the outcome,
mm-hmm.
Rather than the actual doing. So I think knowing how the world works means, you know, just taking a step back and trying to view things from the perspective of what's actually happening, you know, rather than what I think is happening. So to basically get out of your own way. If you can do that, then you can see what's actually going on.
So not knowing how the world works is knowing how to be satisfied, right? I mean, because looking for satisfaction from that doesn't align with the world, doesn't align with the world, the way things are.
Right.
It aligns with our own creation. Well, it is our own creation, right? Basically, right? So it aligns with what we create. That's why it feels comfortable, because it's familiar, because we create it.
Right.
So to know how the world works is in a way to go against yourself, right? To go against what you feel aligned with to begin with, then to arrive at what you are aligned with in essence.
Right. You know, so something as simple as, and we've all been in this situation, you know, where you get overwhelmed and you know, someone will tell you, or you decide yourself, just take a deep breath, just take three deep breaths or something like that. And then all of a sudden, everything kind of dissipates.
Yeah.
So all that sort of emotion and expectation and all that stuff that's built up around some thing or some outcome, you know,
mm-hmm.
you stop, you take three deep breaths, and it just dissipates. So
right.
You realize that it really is not much of anything.
Yeah, looking back at things that were a big issue in the past, it has dissipated, right? All of it dissipated. All of it today is not as important as it was.
Right. But this is an intentional life perspective, right? You can't do this by accident.
No.
You know, you have to constantly be reflecting upon your own position.
Excuse me, on Zoom we cannot hear except for Junru. So if people who are speaking could use the microphone, it would help us on Zoom. Thank you so much.
Thank you for letting us know.
But I think that there's a bit of a trap in this as well of reaching that conclusion. It's very easy in the face of what we maybe mistake the world as being and what it is, depending on where you are on the totem pole, as it were, or the food chain, is that that could lead to an incredible amount of defeatism, mm-hmm. of going, well, if this is the way the world is, and I'm on the bottom of a shoe, then why, you know, it's about where do you take that next step, I think, is that realizing that the world, as we are experiencing it, by and large, is the suffering, especially, is of our own creation.
Mm-hmm.
It needs to kind of happen in tandem with, and it could be otherwise.
But isn't that what we're trying to do, though?
Yeah,
like, if you realize that you're on the bottom of the shoe,
yeah.
it gives you the freedom to not be under the shoe anymore.
True.
Right? It gives you the freedom to readjust.
But I'm saying that, like, even that decision of recognizing the freedom takes a deliberate point of going. You could easily say, well, then the order of the world is that I'm on the bottom of the shoe and I should just accept the slot. And
what does that mean, though? What yeah, does right. it mean I'm at the bottom of the shoe? Can you elaborate?
Right. You know, there's, regardless of how we feel about wealth and things of that nature, it does create varying degrees of comfort and maybe direct experience with suffering of, you know, not to play suffering Olympics, but there are varying degrees of suffering to certain extents. And when you are experiencing a certain thing and reinforced that you are essentially in the bottom rung of a social hierarchy that's been created, and bottom rung being like whether it's extreme poverty or the type of labor you're engaged in or you know, famine or war-stricken areas, and that's where it could go into a lot of different ways of, you know, this is how do you change and work with forces that feel so beyond your control, and it can slip into, well, then I think this is, you internalize it and go, I'm just meant to be at this point versus I have the freedom to do otherwise. Instead of it being this is all there is, and it opens up into freedom of something else, it could lead to just
right, but the freedom lies yeah. in not naming or not right. fixating, right? So if you don't fall into that trap of saying I am that, I am this, I'm this, that, yeah. right, or that's all
and
I'm worthy
is,
of or can do,
is,
right,
yeah.
then right, so then there is freedom.
Yeah,
so we cannot, there's no way to recreate something. Thank you. There's no way to recreate it, right? So we have to stop creating.
Right,
so it's not like, well, I'm okay, I'm accepting my situation, I'm just
right,
that's all I can do, I am, I got
the realism
screwed.
Of it, or pragmatism or whatever, of going
right.
this is what it is, so I'm accepting what it is. What does that acceptance mean then, I think, is the next step.
That
right?
acceptance
yeah.
is freedom, right?
It
once
can
you
be.
Accept
yeah.
it, and once you see what it mm-hmm. is actually, right, you lost your job, it sucks,
right.
I can't pay my rent. Okay, you realize that,
mm-hmm.
right? You don't realize that, oh, you know, woe is me, it's my fault,
right.
you know, I can't hold down a job, blah, blah, blah,
mm-hmm.
you know, all the things that you say when you're in a situation like that.
Mm-hmm.
But accepting the situation as it is,
mm-hmm.
knowing what life is, allows you the freedom to make decisions to move.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you're paralyzed, I would think. It seems to me.
Yeah.
Wait, of course you're paralyzed. Can you turn it around a little bit? Thank you. In what we call acceptance, in that kind of, ultimately in what we call acceptance, nobody's accepting anything. And that's something that, you know, we can't fit the practice into our own dogmatic way of thinking.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we try to do. And we're trying to understand what the practice is teaching, but refusing to let go of our way of thinking.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't work. It's just not going to work. We're trying to shove it into a very tiny box. It's everywhere. That's why enlightenment is considered the greatest disappointment. Because it is a disappointment. Because you're not going to get anything out of it. Well, then why is it worth my time, right? I'm getting nothing out of it. The hell with it, I'm going to go somewhere else. Because I want something out of it. In enlightenment, then nobody is becoming enlightened. Nobody knows. If somebody tells you I'm enlightened, there's a problem with that statement. Right? What does that mean? So we have to realize that the way we think about it is the trap. Not what it is, right? To understand the world is to stop trying to figure it out. It doesn't need to be figured out. But as long as we think it needs to be figured out, or I need to be figured out, or figure myself out, then there is a problem. As Einstein, you cannot solve a problem with the same mind that created it, right? That's exactly what we're doing. We create the problem and we try to solve it. The issue is with the way we think. The issue is with that. So using the senses, right? Of course, the thinking mind, right, is a governing sense. Using the senses in a different way, that's what we need. Not to define or name, but to express. That's the question. Can we use it as an expression of the eternal, of perfection, of wholesomeness, of God? Right? Because that's what it is. Not my senses. That's how the divine expresses itself. Who am I to do something different with that? Or to come up with my own designations? Right? I got to create a self that then will decide or designate stuff and create numbers next to it. It's made up. And that's a difficult thing to let go, because we don't want to let go of that.
When there's a loss, it's hard when there's a loss to not feel that sense of inadequacy,
mm-hmm.
and feeling like you actually did lose something, or that something's not going to happen the way you want it to. And it's hard to. That's my sense.
Hear.
Can you speak?
That's my sense of what. The sutra is saying is that I think you have to turn the volume up on the box. Can you hear me? Alright. So my sense is that it's really hard when you have a loss, or when you think that something's not going to work the way you want it to. It's really hard for me, at least, to then not get lost in that feeling of I am lost, I am inadequacy, I'm not enough. And I think that's where I slip up. Many places actually I slip up, but that's one of the places where I slip up.
So you talk about inadequacy, right? So what's inadequacy? This is something we do have to look at, right? What does it mean?
I'm not enough.
Yeah, but what does it mean? What are the standards, right? Who is creating the standards of what's adequate and what's not?
Well, I feel like somebody else is. But
who? No, but that's...
I feel like the other is.
Who's the other? Who's in charge? No, I'm serious. Who's in charge?
No, I mean, if you think of it in terms of what we are, then the other... Well, the other is, you know, could just... on a shallow level, could be your boss who didn't want you around, or could be somebody who rejects you because you're not a certain way, you know, so, or you're not what they expected you to be. But you don't, you also don't feel like, I think what also asserts itself is that you don't feel like telling people that you're going to be exactly what they want you to be, because you don't want to be what they want you to be. So there's this conflict.
Right. So as long as we are playing the game, we're playing the game.
Yeah.
And the whole point, what we're saying before, is realizing that playing the game doesn't lead to any long-lasting contentment,
yes,
or equanimity. That's the point. So right now, it's after having some realization,
yeah,
or at least acceptance, that playing the game will not lead to what the game is promising. The promise is there to keep us all in the game. It's not going to deliver, but the promise is there, so let's just all play the game and pretend that it will lead to some contentment. Because imagine if people realize it, it's not good for...
But then the inadequacy is always there.
You're always under review.
Always.
Right, but that's a misunderstanding of the world. That's the point, what we say, right? There is that, right? So, right. So this is what we call taliki. Worldly power has everything to do with how many people give you a thumbs up.
I think it's like in Hinduism described as rajasic. Like,
right, how do you turn inwardly and discover,
yeah,
jyotiki, discover real, true spiritual power?
Yeah.
It's not to seek, it's to discover within.
Yeah.
But we have to pull away from the game at least a little bit on a daily basis, not sit in zazen and think about it, because I think a lot of us do. I'm not gonna say who. But we could be sitting in zazen and then have those thoughts, right? I am inadequate. What do I need to do to appear more adequate? Why is he or he doing this or that? They should be acting differently, right? We sit and do that in zazen. We can do it. Of course we can do it, because nobody, right? It's like, I'm going to stay still. I'm not going to move. So everybody thinks I am doing really great, right, with my zazen. Now I am free to think whatever I want to think. Yeah, we know what it is, right? That's what we do often. But that's not what the practice is asking us to do. This is the energy we have to, the addictive energy we have to step away from. We have to, again and again, even if it's 5 minutes out of a 40-minute period, still, it's great. 5 minutes, just rest in being. Appreciate being for 5 minutes, I think goes a very long way. Because you train yourself to not take your mind so seriously, to not take your thoughts so seriously. What does it mean? It means what I assign, what I give it. As an assignment, I give it that name, that definition, it's going to mean that. But I was told that that's what it means, is what you're saying, by others. Do they know? How do they know? Does it work? Has it worked for them?
This is my problem with authority.
Right?
This reminds me of the problem with the experiment that monkeys, I will do very brief description. There was a monkeys that were in the cage, and they were like a banana, and they were kind of getting to the banana, and somebody was like with water, with high pressure water, kind of bringing them down, you know, every time. And so they all learned that they couldn't get to the banana, so fine. So then they would start changing the monkeys one by one. And when the new monkey was trying to get to the banana, because everybody was getting water, they were like hitting him and not allowing him to get to the banana. You know, and then they changed all the monkeys, and nobody got wet. You know, no monkey got wet, but all the monkeys were hitting each other, you know, when they were trying to get the banana. You know, and so they didn't know why,
right,
but they were clear that the banana cannot be gone. And so that's what we do. I mean, like, because you should say, like, who is them? Well, then they're playing also the game, and they were told that to be a boss, they need to be mean to you.
Right.
And the other guy is also playing the game, and they were told that blah, blah, blah. And everybody's playing that game, and so we are all told our own piece of story. And that's how things like, I mean, the monkey was funny, but how the Holocaust happened. Because everybody, I mean, there was a truck driver that was told to drive people.
Mm-hmm.
And he kind of could have guessed what's going on, but he didn't mind to, because he was told to. You know, and those are the things that we kind of keep going, because it's like, okay, we're playing the game, because I mean, otherwise I'm gonna get like some short straw in the game.
Yeah, it's easier to play the game. That's why it takes great discipline to stay with practice, because you have to go against the grain. It's a lot easier to follow along, to go with the habit, to just do what everybody else does, to think the way other people think. It's easier, which is what we know. So it takes great courage
and to do
otherwise.
It's so normal to do that. Like, and you can tell, I mean, we watch actually kids playing games, and sometimes they get so aggravated when they don't get what you want. And you watching that and you're having fun with it because it's like, you know that it doesn't matter. And I can guess kind of a higher and like eat, mm-hmm. having fun with us, looking at us and say, ha ha, they're kind of pursuing what? You know, like, what are they game? What's their game? And why they're so worried about it? And how to drop the worry about the game? I mean, like, I guess it's inevitable that we need to play.
Mm-hmm.
We're here. It's part of it. It's like where the delusion lies, and the delusion is part of nirvana, and we're here, so we play the game, you know. But how do we play knowing that it's like not really that important? It's kind of what you're just saying, the 5 minutes of, oh, my thoughts are not really that important, I can just be here without
mm-hmm.
that.
Right, so the question of how vested I am, right? If I'm not vested, I'm free to play it. If I'm vested, I'm not free to play it. Either way, I have to do it, right? The question is, am I vested? Am I at the point of realizing, am I resting, able to rest in being right now? If I'm able to rest in being right now and I know being by experience, then I'm not looking for anything else. Then I'm free to do. Otherwise, I'm not free to do. I'm doing, but I am tethered to that. I am looking for to gain something. So the gain and loss will come. So I'm gonna keep reading, and then also on Zoom, yes. Go ahead.
If I may,
can you raise the volume, please? Go over there to the bottom on the right.
Am I heard?
Yeah, you can keep talking.
Okay. You know, we're talking a lot about the discriminating mind, of course, and I think one of the things we're also talking about is discrimination. And social strata and subjugation and histories of these things, and how we set up our relations structurally within the context of culture and environment. And this, I've had this question for some time, you know, when I think about what it is to know the world and to know equanimity, I can find this place of centeredness and connection and do this thing also, the humble braggart, I call it, where I feel so great about my ability to feel equanimity. But I've done some work around anti-racism, and I worry about this equanimity feeling, and its dismissal of failing to recognize the treatment and histories of people who have not had the feeling of equanimity. And just saying, oh, we're equal. It's kind of like saying, instead of Black Lives Matter, I say all lives matter. And so I struggle knowing that's not the point. Zen does not try to erase the histories of people. And yet when we talk about equanimity, I don't know how to work these things together.
Right, thank you for that. So, you know how we say, so when you look at the five fingers, right, this is just a simplistic way of going through what you're saying. This is a misunderstanding. That's not what Zen means, as you're saying, right, or the teachings, right? So differentiation without equality is wrong differentiation. Equality without differentiation is wrong equality. Do you see? So equality without differentiation is wrong equality. Not realizing the differences are equal. Equality is different, right? It's not, again, the way that you're describing it is the same thing I was talking about before. We're trying to shove it into the way we think, and we make it convenient for us, right? This is a convenient way of thinking about it. This is not abandoning our attachment to thought. This is just using it differently, but it's still attachment to thought. Right? Oh, we're all the same. We're all one. Whatever, you know. I don't see that you're different. That's not. This is just us using it. That's not us really understanding what it means. So equanimity has nothing to do with one or many. It's not one or many. Neither this nor that. That's where it goes much further than what the way our mind can analyze it. So what you're describing is just another convenient way of thinking about it. Meaning we make it convenient. You see?
Thank you.
Yeah. But we'll talk more about it. Remind me. Okay, so I'm going to accepting the six dusts as an expression of enlightenment. Indeed, to accept them fully is identical with true enlightenment. This is perhaps one of the most crucial lines in this poem, in the Shinjin Mei. Acceptance here is not used in opposition to rejection, but rather in the sense of letting things unfold according to their self-nature, their thingness. Which is related to what you're saying. This kind of acceptance is the middle way between indulgence and rejection. Accepting the world of senses and ideas refers to the radically transformed perspective in which one sees the dependent arising of things, sees their impermanence, sees their lack of self-abiding, and has compassion for those who make investment in this fleeting world. To have compassion, to understand it that way, means to have compassion for those who make investment in this fleeting world. Right? And that's going directly to the way we think about things. We are attached to, we are vested in, because we don't know that, we think that's the only way to be. We think I need to do something in order to become something. Right? If I'm not, then there's a problem. But who's saying there's a problem? Who's saying you gotta be somebody? Thus one has no compulsion. I'm still with the commentary. Thus one has no compulsion to indulge in or reject this world. Right? Neither indulge in or reject it. Right? There's no compulsion. And that's what he's talking about in terms of equanimity. The world becomes transparent in this radical transformation. Dan and Jordan have translated the two lines above as use your senses to experience reality, for they are a part of your empty mind. This empty mind takes note of all of it perceives, and is guided by its senses or its sensing needs. This points to the crucial understanding that the senses themselves can be a skillful tool to discern the nature of reality. After all, we are human animals, and compared to other animals, we have the freedom to choose between either being prisoners of our skeletal and brain systems, or using those very systems to understand ourselves skillfully. Right, so to be prisoners of our skeletal and brain systems. It's true, we are prisoners of our own device. Right, of our own senses. And blaming the senses is not taking responsibility. Right? It's just, I did it because it smelled good and I went and I did this or that. I thought that was a good idea, and I went along with that idea. It's not me, it's just my mind led me to that. Right, so to intercept, every time we see it in Zazen, the practice is to intercept that automatic mechanism between the sense arising, saying something, right, the mind saying something, and us following it. So then when we get up from sitting, maybe a little bit more freedom. So, anything you want to add to that or share or any questions? Jifu, does that help?
It helps. I struggle with this. Social justice being an aspect of Zen tradition, and also feeling like I'm being asked to like be a dormant.
So being a doormat, right? That's our, again, our own creation, right? Our own interpretation, right? So being under the shoe, right? You said,
yeah.
Right? So that's fixating, that's defining, that's taking what's dynamic and then seeing it as static, right? I am. But how can I be that? If I am constantly shifting and I'm dynamic and I'm of impermanent nature, how is that possible? It is only possible through thought. If I think I am a doormat, then I am going to go along with the definition of what that means, right? What does it mean to be a doormat? It means, that's who I am now. So I'm going along, so I'm playing the game, right? And I think that's my job in that game. Right. Now, social justice is not part of Zen tradition. It's what we can do with it, right? And maybe we should, because maybe it's helpful, right? Or to examine. But the Zen tradition doesn't have any specific way of expressing itself. At any culture, right, different times, it has been expressed in different ways. Now we call it social justice. Fine. What does that mean? Right? Because if we use that as a way to define or be defined, well, I'm the one who is doing good for the world, doing good for others, or I'm seeing equality, right? So I'm a great person. There's nothing in that other than our own creation. So Zen has nothing to do with anything. We should begin with that. Nothing to do with anything. Now, what do we do? So I don't think we should do that to the practice. I don't think we should dress it up. I think we should leave it naked all the time. Right? Because otherwise we think it means, Zen means that. Zen doesn't mean anything. So it's important to be reminded of that again and again, because I think we forget. Yeah.
And I was also, to piggyback on that, I think it's important to note the ways in which many of these teachings can and have been perverted towards very bad directions.
Right.
Many prominent teachers
True.
Were essentially war crimes apologists during World War II in Japan.
True.
And continue to. Motivations abound, but it's still the way that the Dharma can be weaponized.
Yeah.
I don't know if there's a word that's counter to upaya, but where it's skill, unskillful means maybe, but it's skillful means towards a particular end still mm-hmm. nonetheless. But
mm-hmm.
it gets frightening the ways in which these things can be perverted, and Zen does ask us to pay attention to that. It does have emancipatory potential on a societal level, but it can also be weaponized and mistaken for something completely different as a ways to push down. Any sort of dissent or things of that.
Right, but spiritual practices in general, how many, when you look at our history, right? We use spiritual practices to just maintain the way we are,
mm-hmm.
but then we hide behind it.
Yeah.
Right? I am justified, right, in doing so by my religion. Mm-hmm. Not only that, by my God.
Yeah.
By my God. Mm-hmm. Right? Somebody actually, I forget, some years back, we had a student who, we used to meditate after class or before class, right, at the dojo, more regularly like that. And then somebody said, I can't do this, he says, I'm not allowed by my religion, right? He said, I have a very jealous God. Those were the words. I have a very jealous God. What does that even mean?
Yeah.
Right? You say whatever you want, and then it becomes something, right? If we say it and then other people say the same, or if we hear it from a lot of people, it becomes real.
Internalize it. Yeah.
Right? It never mind that it's our own creation, it becomes real. Oh, I heard it. I heard it from enough people, it must be real.
Mm-hmm. That's also the arrogance again, that we were talking at the beginning,
right.
The arrogance of any group of people believing that they know the answer. Like if we take it as in the sense, you can say, okay, yeah, the objective here is to be enlightened, so know, anybody who is enlightened enough, you know, he has the knowing of what justice means.
Mm-hmm.
And then we are kind of, we get righteous about it, and then we start kind of, you know, saying, well, we know what justice means. I mean, everybody knows that. Who doesn't know that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's kind of what the arrogance, you know, that is a very dangerous one, because it's like,
right.
we actually think that we know what's best for everybody, and we don't even know what's best for us sometimes.
So. Right. Yeah, go ahead.
I think for, like, I'm talking about upaya and, like, justice and social justice, I do think it has to do with just meeting the moment in what that is. And so it's kind of like when you go to the hospital and you're, you know, you have a, like, you broke your leg or something, you're not hoping that, like, the cardiologist comes around and says, like, this is a quality, like, you know, I'm the doctor. Like, you need a doctor who knows your needs, right? So, and similarly, the cardiologist isn't going to be, like, taking a break while the leg doctor looks at your heart. And so, it has to do with, like, meeting that, what that is in need. Like, I'm a person who, you know, can't go to a regular doctor because they don't understand me. You know, I show up and they're, like, weird about things and they ask weird questions. So I need a doctor who
mm-hmm.
gets what I need.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't, and that's my equality, is
right.
getting the healthcare, you know,
the access
to that healthcare. And so if that means that I need a specific doctor, that's still equal, because that means I get the healthcare I need,
mm-hmm.
you get the healthcare you need, and so forth. And that's just in healthcare, but that I feel like, you know, goes within anything. It's like, same thing with accessibility for anyone who's disabled, who might need accommodations and something. And that's meeting it in the moment,
mm-hmm.
rather than thinking like, oh, well, you know, this is a square peg, so I'm going to put it in a square
mm-hmm.
hole.
Right.
This peg, I'm going to put it in this, and like knowing, pretending you know all of the things.
Right.
That's the good thing about it being naked, is like, there is nothing.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know. That's the good thing. Within equality, I guess. It's not all equal because everyone is on the same line. It's equal because everyone gets the needs that they need met.
Right. Inherently equal doesn't mean not different. And different doesn't mean not inherently equal. I mean, we have to, it's not play on words. We have, again, the problem with the way of thinking is that it is binary. It is this or that. We can't, both does so make sense. The mind doesn't know what to do with that because the mind operates in a binary way. So, and that's what we have to accept, right? So accepting the way the senses work help us get beyond it. So we're not attached to it. We have to accept that's how the mind works. It cannot work any other way. So why are we demanding of the mind to do what it's thinking mind, to do what it cannot do? Or not meant to do? It's a tool. Are we using it as a tool is the question, right? Are we allowing it? No, it's better. Are we allowing it to be used as a tool? We're not using it, but are we allowing it to be used the way it is meant to be used, so the divine can manifest itself through us? That's the question. Can we get out of our own way? So, yeah, Jifu, go ahead.
Thank you. This discussion is very helpful, and I appreciate very much the healthcare comparison. What I'm realizing is I know that Zen is not social justice. I know the dynamic. I know the dichotomy. What I'm realizing is it is arising in me anger. Anger arises.
Is it open-ended anger, or is it towards something or someone?
I don't know what to do with the anger about justice.
Right, and, you know, that's, again, understandable, right? Because we see that there is another way, right? But the one thing that was raised in the commentary is we become compassionate to those who are still vested in the game, right? So to become compassionate is to understand that that's why it happens. It happens because when we are blind, we act in ways that are very harmful. So when we start to open our eyes a little bit or practice opening our eyes, there is also seeing, there is a much better way to act. Why are you doing this? But that's demanding of other people to wake up at the same rate that we wake up. I'm seeing it, so you better see it now too. Right? I think that goes along with arrogance, actually. Because, well, you know, it's like kind of like, you know, you drive by McDonald's and you eat healthy. It's like, what the hell are you guys doing there? Why? Didn't you hear that this is unhealthy? Because I became vegan, so everybody else should be vegan now too. Well, I am partially realized everybody should be at the same level and stop causing harm to one another. Right?
Yeah, but I very much identify with that, and this humble braggart, that's what I just call it.
Yeah, but the pain for seeing that arises from seeing that is real. And the anger, right? Yeah, fine. Then what do you do with that? Anger is energy. How do you use that energy? Right? What's upaya? What is the right upaya in certain situations, right? So you take this energy, you call it anger, it's just a rising intensification of energy in the body. Okay, use it. Use it well. Yeah.
I resonate with what you feel, Jifu. I remember growing up, there were so many prejudices and so much inequality expressed in my family. And it was really hard for me. I think what I really was angry at was them for making me feel like I had to.
Mm-hmm.
I have to be that way. I have to think this about African Americans. I have to think this about Hispanics. Mm-hmm. I have to think this about them. Otherwise, there's nothing of me. And I was angry at them for making me feel this way. And so that anger, you know, does rise in me at times. And I feel it's almost an anger almost at my own race, but it's specifically at my parents who were so blind. So I do feel that anger too. And it's really hard for me to let go of some things like that too.
Right, but can you just microphone a second? Thank you. So that's the question, right? So the only way compassion can arise is if I realize that I am actually free to act differently. As long as I don't think that I or feel that I'm free to act differently, I can be pissed off at those who basically told me that that's how I should behave or think. But when I arrive at the freedom that, well, I can think differently, I can act differently, then I can do that and at the same time be compassionate, because the fact that I'm able to see doesn't mean they were able to see. Or the fact that they were blind doesn't mean I should not be able to see. That's on us. That's on us. All of it has to do with taking full responsibility rather than pointing a finger. I'm mad at you for behaving this way. What about me? How am I behaving? How does the buck stops here, right? How does I stop? How does it stop right now? What do I need to do to make it stop?
Just, when I was young, I felt like I had to be a different person at home than I did. Because I was in the music world.
Right.
And there were people of all sexualities, gender identities, races.
You gotta project your voice.
They were a lot. I'm a voice.
Okay.
So in my world, there were all kinds of people, and I loved it. And I met such excellent, excellent people. And then to go home and to hear all this, and to be quiet about it, I think maybe I was angry at myself.
You know, that's the important thing is, you know, we grow up with a family, right? And the family we grew up with, they have our parents, they have their own way of thinking. They have or have not done any work on themselves, right? We have to give them a break, right? So it's like, well, you know, yes, that's what they were able to do. What about me? What about now? What is my responsibility? right? I remember, you know, early on, I was maybe 12 or 13, I realized, you know, they're not very open-minded about different things, and they're stuck in different ways, and fine, they can be that. They can be this way. So I started to venture out on my own. Like, what else is going on out there, right? What else is going on other than this? We grow up, we start to go out and about. We experience the world differently. Then you realize that you're free, again, to do whatever it is that you want to do that way, right? You don't have to keep going in the same direction. And then you can accept them, and then, of course, compassion comes out of that. Before I move on, anyone on Zoom wants to add? Yes, Kansui.
I like to say thank you. This kind of conversation is very humbling. I understand the anger. I think it's something that I work on a daily basis, but at the same time, it's not something that I can actively hold on to when it comes to social justice. The thing that humbled me is my parents had a different life than I had growing up. And the way that they talk about things, when I get a little uptight, and they have a lot of hope. And that's the equanimity that I see in them and how the world has changed so much from when they were children till now. I don't know, there's something about realizing that this whole thing, I don't know, it makes me laugh sometimes because there are moments when I'm out in the world experiencing it and I don't understand the instances where it may have been racism, may have been sexism, may have been, oh, she looks a little different. And I get home and I just laugh at myself sometimes because if I fixate on that moment at that time, then I think I might react in different ways. But then I get home and I'm like, I don't know why they reacted that way. I don't even have an idea. So sometimes I have to let it go. But it's very different now. I mean, I've gotten to that point now, but I think prior to sitting in Zazen, I would argue with people, curse people out, want to fight because I didn't understand their intention, but I laugh a lot now because there's a lot of sadness. When I think about social justice now, I think about all the lives lost, how things are colored in a different way, how social justice is not just black and white. When I think about racism and sexism, I think about all the time lost in Haiti. And I also think about how it hurts everyone. This doesn't hurt, sexism doesn't just hurt one sex. It hurts everybody. Racism doesn't hurt just one group of people. It hurts everyone. And I think that allows me to move on when there are instances when I do encounter hate. Because I don't look at that. I tend to look at that person like, wow, it's really sad that they cannot see me for who I really am. And they don't even know themselves, essentially, because they only have one way of thinking of the world. And then the world is all around completely. And I don't know, that's some of the things that come up for me. So this conversation is very moving. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for that, Kansui. So, right. So, look, you know, what we do, we study. In a way, we don't study enlightenment, we study blindness, right? We're studying the way we cover it up, right? We don't study wisdom, we study the way we pretend, right, to be something else or someone else, right? So we are looking at the way we're looking at blindness, right? Pretty much that's what it is, right? So if we study blindness, right, we realize how blind we can become. We can understand that other people become blind too, and maybe more so more than us, right? But it doesn't really matter because blindness is blindness. What they do due to that blindness, yeah, maybe it's like, well, you know, how can you do this, right? But still, the blindness is the same, right? So then how can they behave this way? The answer to that is, when you don't see, you don't see. You can't blame somebody for bumping into you if they're blind. You can't blame them, but they don't see. So because they don't see, they create a mental reality, right? A mental version of reality, and then they go along with that. It's like, well, here's my reality. The eyes are not open. They're not seeing reality. They're seeing a version of it made up by the mind. But we should be able to at least understand the mechanism after practicing for a while, right? We know how it works. We know how we become caught up. So everybody is the same, right? We all get caught up. And again, compassion is born from that. So I want to go through one more line, and then maybe we can talk about that for a few minutes. The wise abide in Wu Wei, non-doing. The fools entangle themselves. Another translation, the wise person strives to no goals, but the foolish person fetters himself. In the perspective of radical transformation, there can be no compulsion to have any goals in the conventional sense. The world of the average person is premised on the pursuit of rewards because one sees this as goals that will bring benefits that make life meaningful. Of course, each person's definition of meaning is elastic and self-serving, but radical transformation makes the world transparent so that one sees that there is no inherent meaning in things and that all goal setting in the hope of some benefit is a fruitless pursuit. The foolish person is the consumer par excellence who derives his or her identity from consumptive accumulation. He, she does not see that these very consumptive accumulations become fetters and keep one in bondage. All consumption is based on some conscious or unconscious goal seeking. The wise person restrained himself or herself from such pursuits. The foolish or the ignorant are bound to emotional choices that in turn attach them more fiercely to their ignorance. The wise person, on the other hand, walks through life unswayed and non-reactive. To walk through life unswayed and non-reactive, it means to see everything clearly, right? Being sober, not painting it in any other color. When you see suffering, you see suffering, right? To be unswayed and non-reactive, that's the practice. Yet free to act compassionately and with equanimity, to see and to act, to be free to act compassionately and with equanimity. There is one Dharma, not many. Distinctions arise from the clinging. Does this help? Okay, Yozan, you can't just nod your head. You gotta say something.
I definitely think it helps. A lot of the conversation today, thinking about the world we make for ourselves, and I think you started the conversation off as what is knowing the whole world? And part of that whole experience is allowing yourself to become more aware. And if the whole world is you, then becoming more aware of your own tendencies, more aware of, for instance, when we were talking about being blind, the places that we're fooling ourselves, more aware of that. I've heard people talking about feeling lost in this conversation, and one of the things that's interesting to me, a little story first. I was in Oregon recently, and I was hiking at night, and I had a headlamp on, and I kind of walked away for a bit, and I kind of got off trail, And all of a sudden, I looked around and I was like, I felt really scared. I was really afraid because I felt I was lost and it was really foggy. And I looked up and I saw the moon, and I all of a sudden was okay with being lost. In some senses, all of it to me is that space between lost and found. And if we are able to allow that space between lost and found, there's a comfort there. So that was my nod.
Thank you. Anyone else, whether here or on Zoom, you want to say something? No. So the wise abide in Wu Wei. Is that foreign? Wu Wei, non-doing. What is non? What does it mean to abide in non-doing?
You have to do a lot of doing before getting to the non-doing.
You have to exhaust yourself,
yeah,
you're saying.
Effectively. No, because I think of that because there's a style of farming that roughly equates to like do-nothing farming, and which is basically let nature do what it does, but the amount of labor you actually have to put in and the type of crops you have to plant and how you do, it's a lot of work. It's not just sitting back and go, okay, go at it, you know, like waiting. It's an act. The doing nothing in Wu Wei is an active nothing, I would say.
Right, so active all day, he does nothing, right? As the saying goes, active all day, he does nothing, right? Mm-hmm. So the non, what does the non refer to in the non-doing?
No goals.
Don't.
No goals, okay.
No goals.
Yeah.
I think for me it's kind of like what we talked about with in Chikai when we were like practicing.
Project your voice.
What?
Project your voice.
Oh, when we were talking about in Chikai about how like sometimes the best way to show somebody something is by just not actually showing them anything. What I mean by that is like I felt like every time that you make a step and you think it's your first step, someone else is watching, and maybe they're taking their first step.
Right.
And so it's like actively doing nothing because you're not putting more energy necessarily
right
into showing someone something. But like, I think in households especially, like we were talking about how, you know, your parents might not understand you and you might decide that you want to go on your own path. They're looking, they're still watching as you go on that path.
Mm-hmm.
And that might mean more than you think to that person. Similarly, if you start doing your own thing, someone who might be in the same household position thing as you might be looking and saying, hey, well, you know, if they can do it, so can I. And as that happens, you know, it's just a bunch of first steps that lead into
trust
you can never imagine.
Right, you know? Right. So the non in the non-doing refers to nobody's doing anything, right? Nobody's doing anything. The doing happens, but nobody's doing it. There's no person to do. If there's no person to do, there are no goals to strive for, right? Because it's the person that is looking for the goal. The doing is fine. The person is looking to get something out of the doing. That's where it becomes problematic. When the person is merged, and it is referring to merging, right? Because it's not the person doing this. The person is this. So when the doing and the person are merged, that's all there is. So there is non-doing in the doing, right? So the no is not rejecting, the no is unifying or shedding light on unity, inherent unity. And it becomes easier because there's no wasted energy. When we do things in such a way, there is no waste. We can actually do much more. Because we do just the right, we use just the right amount of energy, right? As, you know, in Taoism we say, you know, if it takes 3 ounces of energy to do something, don't use two, don't use four. Use 2 ounces. The more or less has everything to do with me thinking I'm getting something out of it or I'm not getting anything out of it. I'm just gonna go through the motions because it's not gonna serve me. At the end of the day, after I'm done with this, I get nothing out of it. I'll do it because I have to. So we just drag our feet. That's wasting energy. or I'm really striving to do it to get something out. I want other people to see it. I want them to see how good I am. Again, wasted energy. Way too much effort. So right effort, right? We practice it. We talk about it. Right effort. I think we even spent an angle on that, right? Did we? Did we?
Yeah.
Right?
I thought you were being facetious.
No, I forget. We have a lot of... We can recycle.
It's like we
do those
two times a year.
Right. Anyway, right effort, right? Knowing exactly the right amount of energy, and that knowing is not dependent on the right calculations. It's actually letting go of calculations altogether. And doing just takes care of itself. Or life takes care of itself. So the wise abide in Wu Wei. The fools entangle themselves. So it's very practical. I think it's very easy to see how we can apply it every day, right? Regardless of what we do, we cook a meal, we go to work, we drive the car, whatever we do, we clean. Whatever we do, we can change it, we can work with it to not do it. To not do it. Right? But, and also it can help us see how self-absorbed we are. Right? Because it's a wonderful way to see, I'm vested in something, right? And I can see how self-absorbed I am. How much time I spend thinking about myself, right? That's another way to see that. Because I'm getting something or I'm getting nothing has me in it. So, okay, any last words? We have a couple minutes.
Last point, what you said.
Yes.
Taking us back to the arrogance that you started with.
The arrogance, yes.
Yes, and then we overthink and we think about ourselves, self-centered.
Yes.
And then we think, I deserve it, so I have to get this. And it's always conditional. If I get this, I'm going to be happy. If I
right.
get this, I'm going to be sad. And it's like, oh, I deserve this because I'm such a good person.
Yes.
I have to get this. That's the arrogance part. So,
yeah, yeah. Yes, exactly. Right. That's how we can get in touch with that particular kind of arrogance, right? It's very personal, right? It's not just the title arrogance, right? We are arrogant in different ways. We are self-centered in very individual ways.
And even comparing, oh, that person is so arrogant, I'm not arrogant. And that itself is arrogant.
Yes. Well, because I am and I'm not, right? So it's the same, right? It has me in it. I'm getting somewhere, I'm getting nowhere. Right? I'm measuring it based on my own parameters. Otherwise, how do I know if I'm getting something out of it, I'm getting nothing out of it, right? If I put aside all parameters, how do I know if I'm getting something out of it? Right? I don't know. I have to have the parameters that will tell me. But if I don't measure it, then what's wrong with this? Right? Or with this. Turn it around. What's wrong with this? So. Okay. I think we're good with this. We can wrap it up and continue. Maybe next week or the week after. We'll see. Thank you. It's great. To be continued. Go ahead.
Bodhisattva vows for all. Page 1 if you need.
Creation, time, number.
Let me respectfully remind you, life and death are of supreme importance. Time swiftly passes by and opportunity is lost. Each of us must strive to awaken.